Hello, and welcome to What is Innovation? The podcast that explores the reality of a word that is in danger of losing its meaning altogether. This podcast is produced by Outlast Consulting, LLC, a boutique consultancy that helps companies use innovation principles to solve their toughest business problems. I'm your host, Jared Simmons, and I'm so excited to have Todd Hossein. Todd Hossein is the founder and CEO of Second Muse, an impact and innovation company building resilient economies by supporting entrepreneurs and the ecosystems around them. Under his leadership, the company has designed and implemented programs on all seven continents with over 600 organizations such as NASA, the World Bank, Nike, USAID, the World Health Organization, and the Rockefeller Foundation. The company is a manifestation of Todd's impassioned belief that economic and social systems can be built inclusively and not at the expense of human dignity and the health of the planet. To test his theories and gain a deeper understanding of how to build and execute better systems, Todd earned a medical degree from the University of New Mexico, spent years developing a range of businesses, and co-founded Second Muse in 2008. He's proud to serve on the board of directors of TechSoup Global and the Circulate Initiative. Todd, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Jared. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I'm ready to get to it, so why don't we just dive in? What, in your mind, is innovation?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think innovation, to me, is solving not just the problem in front of you, but the cause of the problem in front of you. You know, I feel, you know, sometimes we see the thing in front of us, and we solve the thing in front of us, but then it just causes a problem for somebody else. And that might even be bigger than the problem that we solved. And so I think innovation is bettering our condition, you know, is improving our lot. And in order to do that, if you think big enough, if you don't think in just, you know, your corner of the world kind of a way,
right?
Innovation not only solves the thing in front of you, but the reason that that problem exists in the first place.
Well said. And when you use the word big, I know she talked about our and big. What does that look like? What does big mean to you, talking about innovation?
Yeah, I mean, we have our own human experience, right? We go through the world and certain things work and certain things don't work. And we see some things, and some things are directly in our personal sphere. Some things are because of who we are. Some things are because of our community. Some things are because of the state or the country that we might live in, or the region that we might live in. We have unique experiences with the problems that we face, but sometimes the solution to solve the problems that you fix needs to be arrived at, certainly informed by our perspective, but also looking a bit beyond that, you know? And so, yes, I'm a man, but I'm part of a family. Yes, I'm in my family, but I'm part of a community. Yes, I'm part of a community, but I'm part of a country. Yes, I'm part of a country, but I'm part of a human civilization that we're kind of like one extended giant family. And so the larger that I can bring my gaze as I'm thinking, the more I'll understand the cause of the problem and what I want to do, and the easier it's going to be for me to be able to think about, am I just kicking the can down for somebody else to deal with the problem, or am I actually solving something?
Right. So when you say big, you're thinking widening the aperture, broadening your view of what the problem and its potential implications, and just taking a broader, more expansive view of the problem. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, the way that sort of plays out in technology is we think about scale, right? How many users, how many customers, how many this? I'm not necessarily opposing that view, saying that that's a bad view, but that needs to be complemented by a similar bigness of aperture, as you're saying. Like scale, not just from a, you know, monetary capture standpoint, but of the impact that you're going to have on the world. I was born in a country that used state-sponsored surveillance to kill lots of my co-religionists, sort of like being a Baha'i, you know, having born in Iran.
Right.
We know that that's a problem with, you know, social media and the personal data economy today. And there's amazing things that have happened with that technology.
Right.
But if we can also similarly think about, you know, well, what are some of the pitfalls that have happened elsewhere in the world when something like this happens, then I think that we can avoid getting into trouble, which, by the way, is bad for the very innovations that we're trying to scale in the first place.
Right. It's these hidden dominoes that fall just outside of the frame that you're looking at.
Yeah.
And considering what else might be going on just outside the picture.
Yeah.
No, that's a great example. And thinking about how can I monetize an app or monetize a game or something?
Yeah.
And the dominoes that fall all the way to the types of implications that you're referring to, it's really important to kind of have that view. And be able to appreciate it and be motivated by it, but not to be paralyzed by it.
Yeah, totally. We know how the adverse effects of social media that has on young girls and their images of themselves. Mm-hmm. It totally creates harm, right? And like that evidence is really incontrovertible. However, there's nothing that says that social media has to be harmful. But you know, like if we would have designed it and built it with that in mind of, hey, who is this helping? Who is this hurting? Is this causing harm? And right now, big social media companies are struggling because of the criticism that they're getting.
Right.
You know, not dissimilar to kind of like we built a fossil fuel economy and it's causing harm, but that harm is coming back and hurting the fossil fuel economy.
Right.
Energy generation will continue, but it's that particular type of energy generation that created a harm that then came back and bit itself in the backside in a sense. And so I think that this idea of like gooder is better in a sense. Think about what you're creating. Think about what the effects that you're having. And that's actually, you're going to be building for a longer term in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can definitely appreciate that. And is this something you think about in stages or phases, or how do you, you know, how would someone start to wrap their mind around how to do that?
This is one of those things that I think that we can all do whatever sphere we're in. Mm-hmm. I can speak, you know, as a CEO of an organization, I can speak about this as a founder of an organization. Right. I can speak about this as just a guy, you know, trying to do better in the world. I can think about this as we run business accelerators, right? We help develop markets. I can think about this from a market development standpoint.
Sure.
I think there's lots of different ways that we can come at this in terms of who we are. But the question that I would always ask myself is, what am I not seeing? What is this going to create down the road? And it doesn't mean that we need to get obsessed on that which we don't see, right? And just because I'm saying think about it doesn't mean don't do what needs to happen tomorrow in order for your business to survive.
Right.
That's a false dichotomy.
Right.
You can build a good business and, you know, monetize what you need to monetize and do really good while also keeping an eye out about, hey, is there any harm? It's risk mitigation, right? Like, am I causing harm? Am I doing something that's going to disrupt something? Let me be aware of what I'm doing so that it can at least inform my calculus of what am I going to do tomorrow?
Exactly. I love that risk mitigation concept. It's just another form of value that might be at risk from one moment to the next.
Yeah.
You know, you've got monetary value, you've got the value of your institution that you're building. You also have sort of this social value that often doesn't get factored in the grand equation of for-profit organizations. But if you factor it in upfront and assign a type of risk to that, then it's just the same type of calculus to your point of risk versus reward. And the horizons almost start to take care of themselves as well, because you can look at a 50-year problem and assess whether or not you're making this more or less likely to occur.
Exactly.
I love the way you kind of frame that. We talked a bit before starting to record about your journey and some of the, you know, experiences and places and things. How did you arrive at this sort of broader view of innovation? What led you to that?
I mean, I think that we're led to something because of lots of things, right? I mean, I had some incredible people in my life that helped me think deeper. I also had a lived experience. Mm. My story growing up with my family was, you know, 200 years of how my people were beat, bruised, and killed. You know, that's kind of like how we kind of come from the history, you know, at least on my Persian side, which is half of me, you know, from a kind of like this story of oppression. I was always kind of confused about that. We emigrated to Ecuador in Latin America, where I grew up, and then emigrated again to sort of the US. And this was always a question for me of like, why do we build these systems that cause so much harm to so many people? I mean, we do it over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
Oppressive systems look different in different parts of the world. You know, sometimes they're based on the color of skin. Sometimes they're based on gender. Sometimes they're based on class. Sometimes they're based on religion. I mean, there's infinite ways by which you know, power is wielded in funny and strange ways, but like we do it so often, you know, because power is funny, you know, power tells the story of its own history. Mm. We sometimes even label this a success, you know, like, look how much we've progressed. Look how much we've, you know, with very narrow definitions of what we mean by progress. Surely we can do better, right? Like this, we were talking a little bit earlier about how, you know, there's this kind of like idea in economic theory of the negative externality, right? It's almost like this, we've bought this idea that economic gain and economic progress must come at the expense of human dignity or at the expense of the health of the planet. And this idea that one needs to come at the expense of the other always just jarred in my mind because it didn't make any sense.
Right.
And so I feel like with, you know, with guides around me, I started thinking more and more deeply about it. And in graduate school, I went to medical school, and studying the human body was really transformational, I think, for how I thought about this, because your liver never tries to outgame your kidney, you know, like they're different, They look different. They do different things. Right. But like your brain doesn't try to, you know, edge out your heart. Mm-hmm. When this competitive dynamic starts to dominate the natural function of the body, we actually refer to it as disease. We refer to it as pathology, right? Like an autoimmune system is like an autoimmune disorder. You know, they're very common, right? We all know somebody with an autoimmune disorder or have one. You know, an autoimmune disorder is literally when the mechanism by which your body operates is defined by competition, not by harmony. Harmony is actually what your body seeks, right? This is why we sweat when we get hot. This is why we shiver when we get cold. This is why we sleep when we're tired, right? Our body's trying to find balance. That's the natural force of our body. It's called homeostasis. Mm-hmm. But when it's out of whack, when it's out of balance, then we call that disease. You know, when a tiny portion of your body hoards most of the resources, you know, that's literally the definition of cancer. Mm. We know so much about when the body is healthy, and we know so much about when the body is sick, and we know so much about why the two states exist. And so this, I feel like, really consolidated in my mind that, oh, okay, I want to dedicate my life to trying to influence markets so that economic growth and economic progress and a thriving economy does not necessarily come at the expense of the dignity of, you know, any portion of humanity. And it was later on that I realized, you know what? If we actually aren't crushing parts of the human family, we're actually going to have a smarter economy. We're going to have a more thriving and a more creative and a more exciting and a more vibrant economy in the first place. So it's not just about do the right thing from a moral standpoint. It's actually just do the smart thing from like a intelligence kind of a standpoint.
Right, right, right. If you take the broader view, see the bigger picture, the whole body versus focusing on, you know, your role as a specific organ, then it reframes it from a competitive to a collaborative system. And you can really think about a society level definition of a homeostasis that could be reached with different types of people from different classes, different races, different countries, different ethnicities, playing different but valuable roles based on their unique point of view in the world.
Yeah, no, 100%.
That is fascinating. And using the human body as an analogy or as a metaphor or what have you, using the human body in that way is fascinating because when you look at the way we're trained and educated, at least in the US, there's a lot of focus on math and science, but science is in the context of chemistry, biology, physics, those sorts of things. But we don't spend a whole lot of time learning about the human body and how it works as children in an organized, structured sort of way. And it does, it comes up so often in terms of, you know, metaphors, you know, even in business books and other places. I wonder why we don't spend more time teaching how the body works, functions to kids at an earlier age.
Yeah, it's a really good question. But we do that to knowledge. I mean, heck, we even do that in medical school, right? Like we do it to knowledge. We segregate knowledge, right? Mm. There's this approach that we have to the structure of reality, which is so segregated, right? You study math and then you study literature and then you study grammar and then you study science and then you study, and even the sciences, you study biology or study. And I get that there's like usefulness in understanding things, but we spend so little time studying the interconnectedness of nature. And there's amazing scientists throughout the course of history that have actually not made that mistake. You know, look at the great botanist, Johann von Goethe, you know, like the great German botanist. Like he would sit there and just stare at a plant all day long to try to figure out what makes it. And he'd be like, "Yo, no, if you cut it up, then you're going to lose what makes it alive." You know, right. Or like, look at how Copernicus described astronomy. He took as much insights from faith and from, you know, religious scripture as he did from looking at the stars, and he would weave them together in the most magnificent of ways. And this idea of the segregation, and our markets kind of do the same thing.
Yeah. Right?
You got to be really, really, really good at one thing.
Yep. I was just thinking that as you were talking, and I grew up in choirs and playing the piano and things. So music is part of my life before math and science and becoming an engineer and all that stuff. And so, you know, when I think about metaphors and analogies and like how to make something make sense in my brain, I usually go to a music related concept. Those were things built on top of my standard education. I think about Mark Twain's quote, "I never let my schooling interfere with my education." And coming back to the broad view you've had from traveling and from living in different places and in different cultures, I wonder if there's a fingerprint that makes an innovator coalesce those things in a certain way, or if those experiences make you more likely to think in an innovative way.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much, I think, of what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of question. But I think that you're putting your finger on a truth, right? Which is, I mean, this is another thing about what is innovation, which was your original question. Mm-hmm. Question of where does innovation happen? It happens at the intersection of two things that previously, you know, hadn't danced, right? Like, if you think about modern genetics, I mean, it started with, you know, Mendel and like peas and, you know, in a monastery, you know, like, I mean, like when you think about genetics and the origin of genetics, he was a biologist is what happened. But if you think about genetics today, it's more about computer science almost than it is about biology in that sense. And this explosion of the field of genetics that we saw with the Genome Project and stuff like that, where you just saw two fields that previously had not existed before kind of come together and just give birth to this incredible field. The same thing happens internally within us as well, right? Like, I mean, like, you know, I grew up at the intersection of, you know, a Persian father and an American mother in a Latin American culture, you know? And so therefore that influences the way that I see the world. Like, you know, your choirs and your piano, you know, don't just give you a party trick. They give you a different way to taste the world. You know what I mean? And so like, you just experience the world in a fundamentally different way. And so one of the things that I always try to do is I always try to surround myself with people that will come at things fundamentally different from what I have, either because they have a totally different lived experience or because they just think totally different than me.
Right.
And I have deep trusting relationships because that trust gives me access to their eyes in a way that I just never would able to have. So one thing is, like let's create as many experiences inside ourselves as humans as possible, which allows us to synthesize information in ways that give rise to new types of knowledge. And I think that that's amazing. But a proxy for that as well is relationships.
Right. Right. Which gets kind of back to your body analogy, is kind of a neuron, you know, axon dendrite kind of thing, right? You know, the relationships to me are those kind of connections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. 100%. Right. So like your kidney will never be able to become your heart because your heart is fundamentally, it's evolved different capabilities than your kidney has, but they're connected through relation, right? Now that relationship happens to be through blood and through nerves and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But like at the end of the day, I can only learn so much about living in Atlanta or growing up in Alabama. You know, at the end of the day, if I want access to that experience that ultimately can give me a new insight, that ultimately can translate into a new product or a new service or a new technology or something like that, I have to be able to see that through your experience. But I'm not going to get access to your experience unless you actually trust me, unless you and I are kind of like in a relation. And so I think that this is also when like, we think about innovation so much in strictly technological terms, but what gives rise to those insights that give rise to those technological, you know, leaps that give rise to those products and that gives rise to an entirely different, it is fundamentally human.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's what's going to move society ahead, you know, at the pace that we'd like to see it move. Are the human aspects of innovation and the inventions that enable that or right on top of it or are leveraged by it are just sort of serendipitous tools to be used along the way. But the more deeply and fundamentally we can connect with each other as humans, I think we will understand each other's problems better and have more resources to help solve them.
Yeah, no, 100%. We were talking briefly before about this idea of like, we think about the market and we think about inclusion and stuff like that. I think that this is also where this type of market behavior is kind of like a virtuous cycle. You know, a vicious cycle is when things get worse and worse and worse. A virtual cycle is when things get better and better and better. And we've seen this actually through our entrepreneurs. I mean, we supported about 1,000 innovations last year.
Wow.
And so when we work with our cohorts of innovators, or when we have a business accelerator, when we're doing something like that, relation and community actually de-risks the venture, right? If you're a venture and you feel like you're surrounded by enemies, you're not going to open up. You're not going to tell people where your weak spot is, because that's not what you do when you're in an unsafe environment. But if you're surrounded by people that are gunning for you, that are like, hey, I want you to succeed, I care about you, then what are you going to do? You're going to be honest. You know, you're going to open up. You're going to talk about what's not working. And if you start doing that, you're going to be able to solve the problem. And if you solve the problem, guess what? You're more likely to succeed in the market.
Right, right. And you're talking about the real problem, the real thing that's holding you back. You're not talking about a proxy for something that you think might be acceptable to mention in this group around these people and, you know, low risk kind of topic to discuss.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's also at the root of professional development for people of color. You use the same professional development resources in-house. You're in a systematically biased environment. And people are just not going to take the risks, expose themselves, have the conversations that need to be had to get to the root of what's holding them back from a performance standpoint. Because they're in a hostile environment.
100%. And why would they, right? Because there's no evidence to suggest the alternate. And the tragedy of that is not just in that case for the people of color. The tragedy is for the rest of us that won't be beneficiaries of their brilliance.
Yes. Yes. Because that's the unseen, unfelt, unknown tragedy. You don't even know what you don't know. You don't know what you're missing out on. And it is, tragedy is a perfect word for it. We talked about innovation and we've talked about sort of the broad view, the societal view, the connectedness that's important around that. What isn't innovation?
I think innovation is solving something that creates a problem for another person. I think innovation is exactly the opposite of that. Mm. I think, you know, innovation is not making a buck. You know, innovation is not creating a problem for somebody else.
Interesting. If something is moved forward at the expense of someone else or something else, then that, in your definition, isn't innovation.
That's the opposite of innovation. Yeah. Because innovation suggests progress. Innovation suggests we move up. If I do something that advances me at the expense of 100 other people, how is that innovation? We just took two steps back.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
And we do it all the time.
Right? Every day, yeah.
We do it every day, right? And we're like, oh, this is, we have the myth of the hero entrepreneur, right? And this like, you know, let's glorify the one win. But like, if the one win came at an enormous expense, that's not a win. It's only a win if your entire point of reference is just that one individual. Mm. This is why your point of reference is everything. Success for who? Progress for who?
Wow. Yeah. That's a brilliant sort of reframing of everything because it takes the impact into account and it's something that is actionable. I can go and look and say, well, that wasn't innovative because of this reason. And I think if we had more conversations about what innovation isn't, I think it would change the way we viewed big companies. I think it changed the way we viewed these hero entrepreneurs. I think it changed the way we viewed the entire sort of structure of investment and private equity and angel investing and all of it. If we talked about, okay, well, we've put our thumb on this and called it innovative, what would the opposite of that look like? Because you've probably got in that portfolio the opposite of that going on.
Totally.
Oh, I never thought about that. That is that's a great way of viewing it.
Yeah. And I think that this is why I think we can't segregate who we are from what we're doing sort of in the world. Like, I mean, this is why, but you're never going to see the harm that you're causing unless you're seeking to understand the harm that you're causing. And you're never going to find it if you don't seek it with people that have a fundamentally different experience from you. Mm.
How do you surround yourself with people that can digest what you're about? Like, there are a lot of investors and a lot of CEOs, a lot of founders and a lot of advisors out there. Is it hard to find people who can kind of operate the way you want to operate?
When we started the company, 14 years or so ago, I felt that it was tougher, right? It was tougher to frame social and environmental justice and, like, you know, good for people, good for the planet in a ways that didn't put you on the opposite side of good economics.
Right.
You know, it was like, we were so sort of like bought into this long con of like economies grow, but it has to, you know, there's a cost, you know, and unfortunately, you know, that's humans and the planet.
It's the price of doing business. Yeah.
It's the cost of doing business, right? Yeah. We were still kind of bought into that. If you look deep enough at history, it feels when you're in the jagged roller coaster that we're taking one step forward and two steps back. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you look deep enough in history, I really believe that we're actually going in the right direction. No system tolerates disease. Mm-hmm. We know this in every system, it is driving towards harmony, right? We know this from a study of the cosmos. We know this of the study of the environment. You know, we know this because of the study of the human body. Mm-hmm. Every natural system in the world that we can study, yes, sure, you can find competition.
Right.
Right. You have predators and prey and something like that, but the predators will never out-predator all the prey.
Right.
And pile them on a trophy stack. Because they know that they're going to starve. Like, at the end of the day, nature balances it. So, I mean, we even saw what happened with the health of the environment in the first year of COVID, where you started to see this incredible, like, you know, we were all watching the planet heal themselves because our emissions kind of just disappeared over. I mean, they're of course back now, but every natural system that we've studied, and I haven't studied one that doesn't, unless, again, if I'm looking really, really super small.
Sure.
But if you look at broader sort of systems of reality, they all strive towards harmony. And I feel like, you know, as humanity, it's so much easier to have these conversations today than it was 14 years ago. Like before, I had to twist myself in pretzels to talk about incorporating social, you know, inclusion and how do we, you know, include people that weren't, it had to be done on ethical grounds and or on the grounds of morality.
Right.
Whereas today, I feel like I don't need to do that anymore. Like, sure, it's good, it's better, but it's smarter too, right? Because it's like, at the end of the day, if you have a city where you're not letting 20% of the population be who they need to be because of the color of their skin. I mean, we're in Black History Month. I mean, look at the clear, I mean, you know, especially for those of us that immigrated to this country, it's really, really easy to see, you know, the structures of oppression, specifically in the US, even though sometimes it's hard to see it from the inside for many people.
Right.
But the tragedy is like, what are all those brilliant children that could have solved the disease, you know, that's affecting you? I mean, if we've seen technological progress over the last 100 years, we ain't seen nothing yet because it's such a small segment of humanity that has contributed to that technical progress.
Wow.
I have a Nigerian friend who tells me if the iPhone was built in Nigeria, it would look different.
Yep.
He's sharing this really deep principle, which is that, you know, we would have built something different. You know, better in some ways, worse in other words, but fundamentally different.
But different, yes.
That would have given us richness.
Yes. Yeah. I think this decentralization of the world of technology, you know, it kind of moving out of California into other places is going to provide that.
Yes.
You're going to put these tools and these resources in the hands of people who are going to build different things. Yeah. And you're not going to come up with the shades of gray with, you know, that, yeah. you know, these... These companies, they're trillion-dollar companies, but they're not that different.
They're not that different.
They could swap CEOs, chief operating officers, and nothing would change because they're not that different.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to have, you know, 30 years from now, the top five tech companies will be different.
Yeah.
They will be structurally different and built around different types of products.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Because, I mean, when they're the same, remember, it's also risky for an economy.
Yes.
When you have three companies that have the identically same business model,
yeah,
you are one catastrophe away from an economic meltdown.
So true. Yeah.
What did we learn from the supply chain crisis and the pandemic? If the whole world is relying on getting their masks out of one factory in China, we're going to run into trouble.
Right.
This idea of diversifying the supply chain is a very real issue because you're going to have to wait 6 months to get what used to take you, you know, 6 days.
Right. Yeah. And I hadn't thought about it in that context. If you look at sort of the industrial revolution or, you know, whatever era you want to call it, the robber baron, so to speak, each of those people had a very different portfolio, a very different set of products and services. They did very different things. They controlled the economy, but it was a distributed risk, which allowed for collusion and all those other things. But if you look at, you know, Carnegie, Rockefellers of our day, they all basically do the same thing and rely on the same sort of business model. That I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, totally. And why is it? I mean, we have really strong evidence that when women join publicly traded companies on the boards of directors, they perform better financially.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is it because women are smarter than men? No. Is it because men are smarter than women? No. It has nothing to do with the nature of it. It has to do with the fact that now you have more diversity.
Breaking the homogeneity of thought.
You don't have homogeneity because homogeneity is horrible, horrible, horrible for anticipating the future. That's why innovation is not homogeneous.
Right, right.
Because you are less likely to see a future which doesn't exist if all of you are seeing the same thing.
Your risk becomes infinite because you're all looking in the same direction. And so if something happens that's not in that one direction that you're looking, that you're going to fail.
And humans, we're not built for accuracy. We're built for speed, right? When we think about the early cave people, when you had this lion coming at you, you know, those people that were like, you know what, let me suspend judgment and let me think about the lion. Maybe the lion's coming in for a hug. You know, let me just give the lion the benefit of the doubt. Like, you and I are not from those people.
Right.
like the evolutionary chain ended like a long time ago for that.
Right.
We were from the ones that were like, oh my God, I'm out of here because this thing's going to come get me and I'm up the tree. Rapid judgment. You don't have a lot of data. You make a conclusion and it is really hard to shift your mind from a conclusion that you've actually are. That's who we are as humans. We need each other to de-risk our futures, like in ways that are pretty profound.
Yes. Profound is the perfect word for that. It makes me more optimistic for the future. we've got more and different minds looking at complex problems together, which by your definition of innovation means that our best days from an innovation standpoint should be ahead of us.
I 100% agree with you. And I think it's almost like when you think about things like the types of problems confronting humanity today, I mean, they're so hard to anticipate. Just look at the new climate reality that we exist in, right? Mm. We have a much more aggressive climate moving forward than we do looking back. We also have more structures of human civilization that are being built moving forward than we have back.
Right.
So you have this moment where you're getting, you know, more and more increasingly aggressive climate, which means that what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to adapt. We're going to have to be resilient. We're going to have to take these body blows and get up. But when we get up, what are we going to do? Where's the idea going to, like, you diversify your portfolio, right?
Right.
Why? Because you just never know. You don't put your eggs in one basket.
Right, right.
I learned that in a freshman study in economics. You know, like, you know, you don't put your eggs in one basket, you know, like, right. I mean, probably learned it when I was five.
Right.
To think that your ideas are not influenced or informed by your experience growing up is just nuts.
Right.
Like, what idea have we gotten that's not either directly informed or influenced by who we are or what we're growing up or who we were hanging with?
Right.
So, I mean, let's just keep connecting the dots, right? So therefore, in order for us to have a creative, resilient economy, it cannot happen without an economy that ultimately encompasses and reflects all of the people that live over there. And the more diverse that group actually is, the wider the pool of ideas you're going to have. And in an era where it's becoming increasingly hard to predict the future.
It almost feels, if I broaden the aperture out from a human evolution standpoint, it almost feels like we're adapting to our challenges. We're becoming more diverse in the way we approach these things at just the time that the problems are becoming more complex.
Yeah. I mean, how else are we going to do it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about climate change, yes, it's about carbon, but it's not just about carbon, right?
Like, right.
Yes, it's about greenhouse gases, but it's not just about greenhouse gases. It's also about our perception of our relationship with our environment. It's mm-hmm. also about our perception of our relationship with other humans, right? Other humans are already facing catastrophic existential suffering. And I talked to our Pacific Island brothers and sisters about how they feel about climate change.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. We are at different points on the wave or the crest of this issue. Well said. Atan, any advice that you would offer for innovators or people who want to be innovative in the way that you think about things?
I would say choose very carefully who you spend time with. Mm. By saying that, I mean, surround yourself with people that do not think like you. And I'm not saying that, like, if you're nice, surround yourself with mean people, right? Like, to be really clear, right. Like, right. I mean, surround yourself with people that come at the world differently than you are. Always surround yourself with good, competent, hardworking people. I'm not replacing that. What I'm saying is that we all come at things a little bit different, you know, like, the geniuses of the past were individuals that wrote these magnum opus, you know, they would write their magnum opus and they would be the father of this field or the father of that field or the mother of this field or whatever.
Right.
Like, the geniuses of the, you know, of the future are going to come at the intersection of minds. They're not going to be born in strictly one mind. And so, you know, build that community around yourself of people that think differently than you. Mm. And don't settle for compromising somewhere in the middle. You know, challenge each other to get to a deeper truth. Mm. And if you can figure that out, like, there's no problem you can't solve. Mm. The way of innovation is much more important than the innovation itself, because the innovation itself is going to only last so long.
Right, right, right. Yeah, the fruits of that environment have a shelf life, but that approach is what you're saying is the approach is timeless.
Yeah, and this is what we mistake. Mm. We mistake the fruits with innovation itself. The technologies and the things that we see and the drones and the AI and the right. ML and the, you know, that's not the innovation. That's the fruit where it was inevitable. Mm-hmm. It was inevitable that would come out because of the context from which it came. So build the environment where innovation becomes inevitable. Mm.
Well said. That's just perfect encapsulation of that thought. Thank you so much, Todd, for your time. It's been a pleasure. I'm sure everyone will get as much out of this conversation as I did. And you've helped me rethink, you know, things I'm going to go operate differently after this call. So thank you very much for your insight and your genuine passion and your purposeful passion in this space. It's much needed. And thank you for your service to the world.
Oh, it means the world coming from you, Jared. Keep fighting the good fight with the podcast. I really enjoy it. Thank you for having me on. Really appreciate it. Thanks, Jared.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this week's show. You can drop us a line on Twitter at Outlast LLC, OutlastLLC, or follow us on LinkedIn where we're Outlast Consulting. Until next time, keep innovating, whatever that means.